This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. When Sultan Mehmed II rode into the city of Constantinople on a white horse in 1453, it marked the end of 1,000 years of the Byzantine Empire. After holding out for 53 days, the city had fallen. And as one contemporary witness described it, quote, "the blood flowed in the city like rainwater in gutters after a sudden storm," unquote. It seemed to mark the end of the classical world and the crowning of an Ottoman Empire that would last until 1922. Constantinople was a city worth fighting for. Its position as a bridge between Europe and Asia and its triangular shape with a deep water port made it ideal both for trade and defence. It was also rumoured to harbour great wealth. It was a place of fabled splendour. Whoever conquered it would reap rewards both material and political. Earlier attempts to capture the city had largely failed. So why did the Ottomans succeed this time? What difference did the advances in weaponry, such as cannons, make in the outcome of the battle? And what effect did the fall of Constantinople have on the rest of the Christian world? With me to discuss this are Roger Crowley, an author and historian, Judith Herrin, Professor of Late Antique and Byzantine Studies at King's College London, and Colin Imber, formerly reader in Turkish at Manchester University. Roger Crowley, in the 15th century, the Byzantine Empire was in decline. It had lost most of its territory. Briefly, why was that?
In a nutshell, it was the result of an extremely long process of external pressure and internal decline that goes back many centuries. At the end of the 11th century, the empire started to come under pressure externally from the east and the west. From the east, this came in the form of Turkish tribal raiders who started to push into Anatolia, Asia Minor. At the same time, it was coming under military and economic pressure from the west as a result of the Crusades. The Crusaders passed through Constantinople and eyed it rather covetously as a very rich place. And in the aftermath of that, one of the signal disasters of Byzantine history was the Fourth Crusade of 1204, which the Venetians hijacked from going for Jerusalem and sacked Constantinople instead. The upshot of this was catastrophic for the Byzantines. The emperors were in exile for 60 years. The Turks pushed on into Asia Minor, and out of these warring bands, one emerged under a tribal leader called Osman, whose people became known subsequently as the Ottomans. The 14th century, calamitous century in Europe, was equally calamitous for the Byzantines. Civil war, population decline, plague. Constantinople was the first city in Europe to be hit by plague rats coming on ships from the Black Sea. The Ottomans continued their advance. They crossed into Europe as guests of one of the warring factions in the Civil War. And by the end of the 14th century, they'd established themselves in Europe. They smashed the Serbs, and they created a capital at Edirne, 140 miles to the west of Constantinople. And the emperors of the empire were reduced effectively to vassals of the Ottoman sultans. They were in a very weak position.
Well, that's a wonderful overview. Can I just pick out two things, if we could do that? So it had reduced from what to what in about 1453? How big was it? It was the empire and emperor. What was it? It was a city and what else?
It was a tiny footprint. It was a city with some small hinterland and effectively the Peloponnese, southern Greece, and that was more or less it. There wasn't much more.
And this amazing sacking of it by Christians, cracking a Christian city by Christians in 1204, that was extraordinarily debilitating. Can you elaborate on that a little? I mean, the glories that we see in Venice were looted from Constantinople, many of them, weren't
they? That's right. And one of the real symbols of the decline of Constantinople was the four empty plinths in the Hippodrome, which, of course, had... house the four horses which had been carried off to Venice, and these were kind of like, it seemed to like an ultimate symbol of the decline of a great empire, and it left a legacy, a long legacy of bitterness between the Catholic and the Orthodox world, the events of 1204.
Judith Heron, until 1453, apart from this unchristian incursion, there had been other attacks on the city, and they had been beaten off, as I understand it, or can you give me some detail about that?
Many, many attacks, starting in the 7th century with the Avars and the Persians in conjunction in 626, a very important symbolic moment because the victory was attributed by the inhabitants of Constantinople to the Virgin Mother of God, Theotokos. And she became the defender of the city and gave it her very special protection. And the inhabitants believed firmly that she would come to their aid, as she did in all the subsequent sieges, when she was frequently seen, allegedly, fighting on the walls beside the Byzantines. So they had very great faith in the divine protection that had been accorded to them. And they managed to beat off the Bulgars in the early 9th century, attacks by the Russians in the 10th, and numerous other sieges right through till the major siege of 1422, when the Sultan Murad II was absolutely confident of capturing Constantinople and even sent out instructions, news, to his subjects to come and prepare to plunder the city, because he knew and they knew that it was very rich and they were all lined up to come and enjoy the booty. That was not to be, but in 1453 is what happened.
What was the great strength of the city? Why could they not conquer it? They turn up again and again and again. We'll get to 1453 in a moment or two. What strength was it? Simply the depth of the fortification?
The depth of the fortifications was very, very impressive. These early 5th century walls were a major architectural achievement, a feature which is still very impressive today, even though they've been much destroyed and now patched up and restored. But there was a very simple triple system of a very major inner wall with many towers, an outer wall and a huge moat, three barriers which every besieging force had to tackle one by one.
Let's fit another piece into the jigsaw, Judith Heron. And there was a growing isolation of Constantinople, not least in the schism, after following the schism with Rome, where they set off as equal cities and equal, let's call them patriarchs, in Rome and Constantinople. And then Rome began to demand supremacy, and that Byzantine should kowtow to it.
This too has Byzantine. A very long history, and I think it's quite clear that the notion of two major centres of Christianity, Latin in Old Rome, Greek in New Rome, that had developed over many, many centuries. Originally, the five great patriarchates included Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. And the five together were said to constitute the Pentarchy. And this rule of five was the way in which the councils, the universal councils of the church, were organized right up to the 9th century. And that authority was vested in the five great sees representing Christendom. Of course, the three that were conquered by the Muslims in the 7th century never regained the strength that they'd had before, or the wealth, although they had the authority and the tradition, and continued to govern the Christian populations still living under their control as minority churches within the world of Islam. The real problem is that the notion of the primacy of the heirs of St. Peter, the founder of the Church of Rome, gave the bishops of Rome a greater authority, which they played on. And they called it the primacy of the Bishop of Rome, which was superior in honour to anything that the Bishop of Constantinople could provide. And Constantinople had been a very small church in the 4th century AD when Constantine made it his capital. The bishop had to be rapidly promoted to a patriarchal status. Nonetheless, there had been very good relations between the Christians, and these were only vitiated by the question of the primacy of St. Peter and the wording of the creed, which was, of course, an impossible theological conundrum that was never entirely satisfactorily resolved.
But what this resulted in, as I understand it, is that come critical times, the Church of Rome, for various reasons, was not very willing to send allies and help to what should have been their equal Greek church in Constantinople.
There were, of course, very successful crusades in the 11th and 12th century, but subsequent to the Great Sack of 1204, for which Pope John Paul II apologised on the anniversary, the 800th anniversary of the sack of 1204, these relations were very deeply embittered, as Roger just said. And therefore, the Byzantines were put in a very difficult situation. In order to gain military aid from the West to combat the Turks, there were certain conditions that the Bishop of Rome imposed. And the first was submission of the Church of Constantinople to the authority of St. Peter.
And they wouldn't do that. Colin Imber, if we turn to the Ottomans, they're clearly enjoying great success. Can you tell us about their strengths in the mid-15th century?
Well, the strength of the Ottomans seemed to have been the manpower that they could muster coming from both the Asian provinces and the European provinces, and also an extraordinary organisation in that nearly all of the troops at the siege of Constantinople in 1453 were there because they had to be there. Their names existed in registers, and they received either fees from the Sultan or they received a salary from the Sultan, in return for which they had to perform military service, and if they didn't, curtains, they would be sacked. So that the Sultans could muster troops very quickly. What they had also shown themselves able to do was to master military techniques very quickly. And of course, I think the thing which concerns us particularly in 1453 is the use of cannon. Now, cannon was used in 1422. The Greek source calls them bombardi, in fact, uses an Italian term, but says they were ineffective. What had happened in between? Well, I think the Ottomans faced a major crisis in 1443 to 44 when a crusade with the Hungarians attacking from the west, the Emirate of Karaman attacking from the east, with the Venetians, the Burgundians, and indeed the Byzantines blocking the straits, they could have failed at that moment, but they didn't. Well, what were the reasons for their success then? Well, partly alliance with the Genoese, who ferried Murad II's troops across the Bosphorus for him. They also provided him with cannon. Now, the reason the Hungarians had been very successful in those wars was in fact, their use of cannon. Now, the Ottomans learnt this very, very quickly. I mean, they used cannon before that, but they became a major part of the Ottoman military machine. And where did they get the expertise from? Well, homegrown expertise, of course. I mean, they could already make them. But in 1444, the Genoese from Pera, the city opposite Constantinople, provided them with cannon in order to go and fight the Hungarians, and also, of course, the famous cannon of 1453 was produced by Hungarian Urban, and it's worth noting that he got a house in the newly conquered city afterwards as a reward for his
This famous work. Cannon, I understand it, had to be dragged across Europe by 60 oxen and 2,200 men on either side, pulling it to its place for the siege.
Yes, the number of men, let's say, varies according to your source.
I'm quoting from one of you three, so...
Yes, yes, but it certainly was a very, very large number.
Why did the Ottomans want Constantinople so much?
Well, Constantinople was, from an Ottoman point of view, an annoying city-state in the middle of their, what you might call, an empire. Now, the Byzantines, of course, had no military or naval power to speak of, but they had a very good diplomatic service, and they were able, as in 1443 to 44, to quote just one example, able to stir up the foreign powers against the Ottomans. Secondly, they had another weapon in that members of the Ottoman dynasty who had failed to make it to the Sultanate tended to take refuge in Byzantium. And if an emperor at any stage, as indeed at the beginning of Murad II's reign in 1421, and if an emperor wanted to cause trouble, he would release one of these Ottoman princes and start a civil war. So that was a reason. And of course, it was also an enormous centre of trade, particularly coming from the Black Sea, coming from the Mediterranean. And so it was wealthy, and I think the Sultan would rather have his hands on that wealth rather than the Byzantine emperor.
To round off this part of the programme, Roger Crowley, there's also a lot of superstition in the city on both sides. There was a rumour that Muhammad's standard bearer was killed at one of the earliest sieges in the 7th century, and the myths surrounded the city and its capture. Can you take us through those?
Yes, I would say that both sides were kind of obsessed with prophecies, a lot of them of which had a very millennial nature, particularly for the Byzantines. Some of these go back to the Arab sieges, which Judith mentioned, of the 7th and 8th centuries, when Islam failed to take the city. The death of Muhammad's standard bearer designated the city a holy place for Islam, and it left behind a deep longing for Islam to take this city. And a set of prophecies which were attributed to Muhammad, but which are probably apocryphal, which foretold the cycle of defeat, death, and final victory. They also had this image of the city as the red apple, this kind of centre of wealth and power.
Roger, let's look at the two leaders, Constantine the 11th on the one hand, the Byzantine Empire. Let's talk about him first. Can you tell us something about him?
He was a member of the ruling house of Palaiologos, who had been emperors of the city for 200 years. He became emperor at the age of about 44. He, as a young man, witnessed the siege of 1422, which was quite a serious one. And he'd spent 20 years of his life in more or less in the Peloponnese, trying to shore up the Byzantine inheritance and push back the Ottomans with not disastrous consequences. He was a practical man, a soldier, not a theologian, very straightforward, unlike his brothers, who were rather treacherous. And he was deeply aware of his inheritance as emperor, and he was prepared to fight to the end for this.
What about Mehmed II, Colin Imber, the Ottoman leader, who was 21 years old?
Well, it's difficult to say anything about medieval characters, but he's described by Doukas, the Greek who knew him, as being, in contrast to his father, insolent and violent. And indeed, I think the cliché ruthlessly ambitious would sum him up. He was highly unpopular with his subjects because he drove them, both from the military point of view and the taxation point of view, to exhaustion. But he never stopped. Until he died, his ambition was boundless.
Judith Heron, this was often seen in religious terms, and we've heard about the Virgin Mary fighting on the walls of Constantinople and defending the city. We've heard about Muhammad's standard bearer falling in Constantinople, therefore the Venetian Barbaro talked about the Turkish heathens and the infidels, Christianity versus Islam. Does that hold water?
Yes, I think the Christians really felt that this was the last Christian outpost in the Near East. It was a very ancient Christian city. It had been a centre of Christianity for centuries and centuries, and the Muslims had conquered all the other major centres of ancient Christianity. They did feel that this was a very Christian city with an enormously long tradition, and their pride and their ability, their willingness to defend it to the last man is clearly evident. And, of course, some Western Christians came to their assistance. resistance. It's not to be thought that there weren't Western Christians who arrived in the years 1452 and 3 to support the Christian defence, knowing that the city was completely surrounded, the defenders were totally outnumbered, and that it was perhaps a lost cause.
Let's get some idea of the numbers now, Roger Crowley. How did they measure up in terms of fighting force and weapons as we close in on 1453?
Well, no contest on paper, really. I mean, on the one hand, you had the Ottoman army, described as being numerous as the stars. Very difficult, I think, to estimate the quantity of men that they had, possibly 60,000 fighting men, but a huge non-fighting force of ordnance, labourers, people who could dig trenches, carry out earthworks, drag cannons, an incredibly powerful
mining engineers,
that kind of thing. Mehmet had also built himself a fleet of unknown number of ships, possibly about 140, a lot of which were quite small, about 15 to 18 war galleys, so because he realised that you had to surround the city by sea as well, and Murad had not been able to do that. Inside the walls, it was depressingly easy to count the number of men. Constantine organised a muster, and there were 4,773 Greeks. And about 3,000 foreigners, some of whom were Venetians, Genoese, Catalans, Cretans. And there was one Brit there, a Scotsman called John Grant, who had played a small but very significant part. He was a siege mining engineer. So it was an unequal struggle. They did have some ships as well, mainly Venetian and Genoese ships in the harbour, about 30. But sieges tended to favour the defenders, or had favoured the defenders, until 1453. So they're reasonably confident they could hold out, that their walls are strong, until Mehmet came along with his cannons.
A big cannon, Colin Imbert. I understand it was so big and difficult to load and difficult to cool, it could fire only 7 great cannonballs or rocks a day, but these really hammered the walls. Can you tell us about how the siege began and the effect of this cannon and the other cannon? But the big cannon is the one that seems to have done the real damage.
Yes, because the big cannon was against the St. Romanos Gate, the modern Topkapı in the walls of the city, and that is in fact where the Turks finally entered. So I think you can say it is the cannon that did the job. But there were a lot of other siege instruments involved, as Roger has mentioned, mining, which in the end was unsuccessful. Incidentally, the miners were brought from the silver mines of Serbia, as indeed there was also a large contingent of Serbian cavalry provided by George Brankovic, the despot of Serbia, who was a vassal, if I can use the term, of Mehmet. And also they used siege towers, which some sources actually say were in the end very useful in the final conquering of the city, but it seems ultimately that it was the cannon that made the breach. And the ships were held out of the Golden Horn, which provided a moat on one side of the city, by a large boom, which was successful in keeping them out. And that is what precipitated the famous incident when Mehmet ordered the ships to be brought overland from the Bosphorus into the Golden Horn. Incidentally, he was to do the same thing in the siege of Negroponte in 1470. So it was obviously a tactic he favoured.
So, Judith Herring, can you give us some... It's a chance for us to get into detail, which is great, I think. Contemporary sources paint a vivid picture, the repeated attacks on the walls by the Ottomans. Now, we hear about it, we've got bow and arrows against this massive cannon. So it's a wonderful moment in all... I mean, horrible to be killed and all the rest of it. But still, in terms of... It's a wonderful moment. But we read as well about a terrific amount of noise. Can you just give the listeners some idea of... It started, away and away it goes. What's happening?
Medieval warfare was always very noisy, I think. The Byzantines used to take an organ and a lot of percussion instruments out when they were fighting in the field, and they used to have these huge organs, water-powered hydraulic organs, sound, make very blaring, horrid noises to frighten the enemy. By the 15th century, of course, there was a great deal more in the use of trumpets and drums, lots of drumming, lots of a real racket of noise on both sides. We hear from the Greek sources that the bells would be rung in the city to tell everybody that the attack was commencing, or the day's attack was commencing, and that they should take up their positions, and that women and children then joined the lines of people lifting stones up to the walls to be thrown down at the attackers when they got too close. So everyone was involved. Everyone inside the city was involved. The monks would go to pray in the churches if they weren't actually involved in ferrying water and supplies to the defenders. But the noise must have been something tremendous, and of course that's where Mozart got his notion of the Turkish military music, which we find it's 200 years later, 300 years later, but it is an astonishing tribute to the fact that the Turks had developed this very noisy style of musical accompaniment on their warfare.
And the great cannon thumping through the day.
That must have been a terrifying sound for everybody concerned.
Colin Imber, can you? It goes on. The Ottomans have this incredible superiority in every way you look, ships, men, cannons, and so on. And Constantine is there with his 7,500 men, as Roger's told us. Can you tell us about the? And Judith earlier pointed out that some Christians did come to his aid. Can you tell us about one or two of the more significant ones who did?
Well, the most significant was the Genoese Giustiniani, who took up his position on the wall, in fact, at the point where the cannon was firing. So he put himself quite literally, you could say, in the firing line. And he seems to have been a highly effective leader.
He brought 700 professional soldiers at his own expense.
Yes, he did. And it seemed the final signal for the fall of the city seems to have been, in fact, Giustiniani receiving a wound and going away to have the wound dressed. The Venetian sources, the Venetians hating the Genoese, of course, say that Giustiniani ran away, which is probably not true. But it seems that his absence from the wall certainly encouraged the attackers and disheartened the besieged, and that really was a key moment. So Giustiniani does emerge as, I think, one of the heroes of the defence of the city, and also the tragic figure in its fall.
Are we talking about how close are they getting at this stage? We're not quite at the fall yet, Roger. Are they rushing? You've talked about these three boundaries, obstacles before they got there, the outer wall.
Yes.
And then how near are they getting? It's 53 days, so let's say about 48.
They blasted a lot of holes in it, but Giustiniani had been quite successful in replacing them with a kind of earth barrier, which was actually more effective than a stone wall because it was rather like throwing stones into mud. It kind of dispersed the effect of them. It reached a point where both sides were pretty exhausted, and Mehmet decided that it was do or die. His own troops were starting to kind of get a bit edgy about the whole thing. The prophetic atmosphere was getting to everybody. The weather was very bad, which added a kind of is this the end of the world moment, particularly for the Byzantines, for the whole thing. So he just decided he was going to have to go for it. And there was no secret about an Ottoman attack. You could see it coming. They would have 3 days of fasting and ritual prayer, huge bonfires at night. The Christian sympathizers in the Ottoman camp fired arrows over the walls, telling them what was about to happen. And at 1:30 in the morning on the 29th of May, he started to march his... It was no cunning plan, just three waves. March his men forward in waves, the most expendable Christian troops first, working up to his most valuable troops at the end. Constantine decided that he was going to do or die, so he marched all his men between the inner and the outer wall and locked the doors behind him. So they were going to, you know, go for it, basically. And they held out pretty well for about 5 hours until Giustiniani was wounded, and his men asked for him to be taken back into the city, and Constantine didn't want him to go, but he said, no, I've got to go. Gates were opened, everybody panicked and tried to run for the gates, and of course most of them were locked, and they were surrounded and massacred, and the actual moment of collapse happened, I think, very quickly, and people were surprised how quickly it happened inside the city.
Judith, can we just come on the side of Constantine and in Constantinople there? Roger's given us a graphic idea of his waves and waves of upwards of maybe 60,000 coming at these group of six. Have we any notion of what Constantine thought he was because he still thought that the Virgin would protect them as she had done for nearly 1,000 years or over 1,000 years. So what do we know? What his position in it was?
He hoped for a miracle, and he ordered all those who could pray to pray, and the great church of Hagia Sophia on the 29th of May, 1453, when the city walls were breached, was full of those praying to the Virgin for intercession and divine support. The night before the major attack, his advisor, Francis, rode out together, and Francis later gave a very moving account of how they looked at the bonfires and saw the advancing troops and knew that the end was near. And Constantine looked at his city and told Francis that he was there to defend it. And in fact, since his body was never found, it is quite clear that he preferred to die leading his troops against the Turks than to negotiate any sort of compromise and handover. Francis himself was captured and imprisoned and later ransomed. And in his old age, he was able to write about this. It's a little sentimental, but I'm sure he reflects the truth when he says, or he reflects what Constantine perceived to be his role. He had a duty to defend the city, and as the Christian emperor, he would do that, even if it cost him his life.
Roger, can you just briefly say, when was the moment when the city fell? Was it when Christiani had to be taken through the gate, and therefore the gate was open? Was that the moment when it was all
more out? Or less, yes. Yeah. The Ottoman troops got up onto the walls, trapped the Christian soldiers, then opened the gates, and people flooded into the city and started to ransack it. There was a kind of ceremonial moment when Mehmed entered the city, and which he much reflected in romantic 19th century Turkish paintings of this moment. And he takes on the epithet of the conqueror, as he's called in Turkish. And this is the moment when it's considered to have fallen, but it effectively had fallen but before he entered in.
But before he got in, there were 3 days, Colin Ember, where, as I understand it from reading what you have written, the 3 days were somehow allowed, the soldiers were allowed to loot, pillage, rape. There were 3 days, they were given... There was some sort of almost official licence given. What's all that about?
Yes, there is an official licence. But I think Ottoman sultans knew perfectly well the reason why troops, particularly volunteers, were there, and the things which could keep all troops busy is the promise of plunder. And an immensely wealthy city did indeed promise plunder. And some people did become very wealthy. I can, in fact, quote an early 16th century Ottoman historian, Kemal Pashazadeh, who said, "It is a proverbial saying that if there's any person who seems to have wealth far beyond his humble status in life, he must have been at the siege of Constantinople." And this was true in all Ottoman sieges.
Just briefly on the motivations of the troops. We don't know, I think, know a great deal about the motivations of the Ottoman troops. There was a rather grumpy letter during the siege from Mehmet's spiritual advisor saying, "Most of these men are not interested in dying for God at all, but they'll run for death if there's booty involved." You know, the idea of material reward was kind of infinitely more attractive, I think, to many of them than you know, the hereafter.
And I think they assumed that the city was full of gold and silver and silks and wonderful things that they all wanted. This was possibly not as true as it had been in 1204, but nonetheless, there were sources of gold, and we know from one of the Byzantines who was later captured that he offered the Sultan a great deal of gold for his safety and the safety of the ransoming of his family. And the Sultan turned to him and said, "Why did you not offer this to your emperor before?" And that was Notaras who lost his head as a result.
Can we just conclude this business of the 3 days, which fascinates me? Was it some agreed deal, or was it written down somewhere, or what was it?
I think it was written down in Islamic law. Colin might be able to correct me on that one, but it was a general. It didn't pertain just to Islam; it pertained to all siege warfare. That if you didn't surrender, you could expect to be sacked, and 3 days was a allotted term for this. But actually, within a day, they'd stripped out everything of value. And Mehmet was keen to preserve the fabric of the city intact, so he was very keen to put a stop to it.
Is there any hard evidence that after that day or two or three, this looting and pillaging and raping stopped?
I don't think there's any hard evidence, but I think probably it did, because as Roger said, it had been stripped out within a very short time.
And in fact, sieges prior to that, the siege of Jerusalem, for example, by the Crusaders, was followed by days and days of looting, and there wasn't nearly so much control. So to the extent that there was only a three-day period, that was a limitation which was very much more civil than the unrestricted looting that had taken place in medieval warfare before.
And it wasn't a complete sack. The Christian churches did survive this process. The Church of the Holy Apostles, I believe, survived and was put under guard by Mehmet. And some of the other Christian churches were in some of the villages in the walls, surrendered and took the keys of their little stockade to Mehmet. And they survived the siege as well.
And also, I must remember that a lot of the looting was people. And there was a big slave trade,
and yes. So
younger people and handsomer people, I presume, in terms of women, were looted for the slave trade. Colin, yes.
And not only of humble, everyday domestic slaves, but also of members of the imperial family, because we find a governor-general of Rumelia, of the European provinces of the empire, in 1470... trading under a Turkish name, Has Murad Pasha, but he was a member of the Palaiologos family. And indeed, Mesih Pasha, the Ottoman commander at the failed siege of Rhodes in 1480 and later Grand Vizier, was also a member of the Palaiologos family. And another Greek vizier of the 1460s is known in Turkish as Rum Mehmed Pasha or Mehmed Pasha the Greek. So we know that there were Greeks, that the old aristocracy, if I can call them that, continued to trade, but under different names.
Can we just develop what Roger said, Judith, a little about the treatment of the Christian monuments in Constantinople?
We know that Hagia Sophia, the cathedral church, was rapidly converted into a mosque and remained a mosque, of course, until it was secularized under Ataturk and is now a museum. The other churches, we learn, were some of them were converted to mosques. One was reserved for the Greek patriarch, Skolarios, who became the leader of the Greek group, the Greek ethnic group under the Ottomans. And the Church of the Holy Apostles, where the emperors of Byzantium had been buried, was razed to the ground on Mehmed's orders in order for him to have constructed a very beautiful mosque called the Mosque of the Conqueror, which survives today and is a very fine 15th century mosque. But it was clearly a symbolic replacement of the imperial mausoleum and a magnificent church dedicated to the Holy Apostles by the Mosque of the Conqueror on the same place. And it shows how insistent Mehmed was that he should become the master of this city with all its traditions.
And that leads me, Colin, from what Judith said, to the business of all its traditions, that there was a sense of, was there not, of keeping people there from different traditions, from different faiths, from different groups.
Yes, there certainly was, and also in order to revive the city, of bringing people in from all over the empire. That was one of the reasons why Mehmet was so unpopular. He deracinated people and put them in the city. But there's another interesting incident from 1539, actually, which tells us a bit about the survival of the Greek churches, is that an overzealous chief mufti wished to close them down on the grounds that the city hadn't surrendered. And so a rather more clever chief judge produced an 110-year-old man and a 130-year-old man who gave evidence, that's two witnesses as required in Islamic law, that the Christians and Jews of the city had made a secret agreement with Mehmed to surrender, therefore the churches can stay.
But it is, as I understand it, I'd like to develop this just a little bit. The Christians had their own quarter, they stayed, the Jews had. Now, of course, they were penalised with taxes, and some of them converted to evade the taxes and to get on better. But that is, he is definitely, Mehmed is definitely attempting to establish this sort of place, isn't he? Can somebody just give it a bit more colour? Roger, or Judith, whatever.
Well, I think that the whole tradition, the whole history of Constantinople had been one of a very cosmopolitan polyglot, multicultural city which Mehmed knew about and wished to preserve and strengthen. Not only did he wish the craftsmen all to stay in Constantinople so that they would continue to service the city, but as Colin said, he brought in a lot of craftsmen and inhabitants from other places and made them live in Constantinople so that it would flourish again. And indeed it did. Under his rule, Constantinople became again a very prosperous city, and it was to become even more prosperous, of course, in the great Ottoman cultural renaissance of Suleiman the Magnificent in the 16th century. So we have a clear policy of reinforcing the multicultural traditions of the city, which required tolerance, which demanded that those who didn't want to adopt Islam pay an extra tax and keep themselves and their religious celebrations at a low key, no ringing bells or riding horses. But nonetheless, they could carry on. And it's quite evident that there was a very determined policy to build up Constantinople, to make it again a great city and a great capital.
Roger, how did the other Christian countries in, let's call it Europe, react to the fall of Constantinople?
They had, as far as I can see, a sort of like a 9/11 moment. When you read the accounts, you feel that people could remember where they were at the moment that the city fell. You know, people wept in the streets of Rome about this, and it recreated a kind of zeal for crusading. Pius II, Pope shortly afterwards, tried very hard to get crusading going as a project, not with great deal of success. The news of this rippled across Europe incredibly quickly. There were songs, there were poems, there were all kinds of diatribes written up against the Turks. And it was bad luck for the Turks, the Ottoman reputation. Of course, they arrived just as printing was being developed. And one of the things that you see in the latter half of the 15th century, a huge amount corpus of literature in Europe about the terrible Turk. It was very bad for their PR to have arrived on the scene at that moment. But of course, the pubs which had been the Saracen's head in the Middle Ages became the Turk's head, and you start to see this whole projection of the terrible Turk in European thought and literature, and it signalled what was obvious, that the Turks were established in Europe and were going to be there for a long time.
Colin, what about the reaction inside the Ottoman Empire to this?
Well, the immediate reaction seems to judge from very exiguous sources, seems to be not very great. What is remarkable is that the Byzantine emperor has no special titles. He's not regarded as anything very special in contemporary sources. And accounts of the siege are actually very small. It's later, I think, that the siege begins to acquire a symbolic significance. For example, part of the coronation ceremony, as developed from 1595, incidentally, the Sultan took a trip up the Golden Horn to the shrine of Abu Ayyub. Then he came round the outside of the city walls, entered the city through the Edirne Gate, the Adrianople Gate, visited the tombs of his ancestors, and then entered the palace. Well, this was, I think, a symbolic reenactment of the conquest of the city, which somehow emphasised that it was an Ottoman city. And I think also by that time, the Ottomans had begun to treat Istanbul, Constantinople, in the same way as the Byzantines did. It was the city, and the inhabitants were extremely snobbish and thought that anybody in the provinces wasn't worth anything. So in a sense, I think that the Byzantine culture was replicated in the Ottoman city.
Just very quickly, it seems to me it's a history written by the losers. There's very little contemporary Ottoman material that we can point to in any detail. It seems to me that everything we know is being written by people who lost it.
Well, that's a very good ending. Thank you very much, Judith Herring, Colin Ember and Roger Crowley. Next week we'll be discussing the life and work of the Argentinian short story writer Jorge Luis Borges. And thank you for listening.
We hope you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast. You can find hundreds of other programmes about history, science and philosophy at bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.